Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Although you wouldn't know it from the media, war is declining worldwide. Homicide is declining worldwide. And violence is declining worldwide. Violence has been tracked for 60 years, and the trend is definitely down. So says leading peace educator Barbara Wien, our guest today. For 25 years, Barbara Wien has worked to promote human rights and to stop violence and war. She has protected civilians from death squads in conflict zones, led 8 nonprofit organizations, taught alternatives to war and violence at 6 universities, and delivered peace seminars in 58 countries. She is the author of 22 articles, study guides, and books, including Peace and World Order Studies, a pioneering curriculum guide for university professors that helped to create the whole field of peace studies. She is currently on the faculty at American University in Washington, D.C. Barbara Wien is named in Amy Goodman's book, Exceptions to the Rulers, and also in the Progressive magazine for Speaking Truth to Power. You may have seen her in the Washington Post or in NBC Nightly News. We are fortunate to have her with us here today. Barbara Wien, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yes, and I know how busy you are, so I so appreciate you taking the time to be with us. I wanted to start because when we were having a conversation, getting ready for this show, you talked about these trends down worldwide in violence, war, and homicide. And it's hard to believe because we're looking around at the explosions in Brussels this week and the various, terrorist attacks. But tell us, what do you see happening with the trends in violence, war, and homicide?
Well, there has been an emerging global peace network, a system of civil society organizations from democracy building, gender equity, labor, environment, anti-war, peace, human rights groups, gradually building the architecture for a more peaceful world, and it's beginning to pay off. Since the end of World War II, the rise of civil society has been remarkable, and they have been working to build the capacity of local populations to resist hatred, to resist extremism, to inoculate and vaccinate the populations against war. And, of course, soldiers have also been helping to lead these movements. They've seen the horrors of war, and they've come back and helped to be some of the major leaders, Gold Star Families for Peaceful Tomorrow, 9/11 Families, and others, Iraq Veterans Against the War, and, of course, Vietnam Veterans Against the War. So they speak from firsthand experience that war is not making us safer, that it's putting us at greater risk. And so more publics are resistant to going into battle, and we are seeing the emergence of more and more democracies, and more countries have adopted nonviolent struggle in an effort to topple dictatorships, end apartheid, deal with despotic governments, the death squads, and others. And we are now seeing the effectiveness of nonviolent revolution growing. Now, 2014, 2015, we have had backsliding. Syria and Iraq have been disastrous in terms of the global trends. But homicides are down worldwide, and we are seeing that the number of people dying in wars has been declining steadily. So during World War II, there was massive numbers of casualties, as you know, and massive numbers of victims. But we've been building international law, regional security organizations, human rights monitoring teams, and many other mechanisms or strategies and methods for trying to de-escalate violence and negotiate peace accords. One of the greatest trends we're seeing is the rise of women's rights and the role of women in trying to forge peace agreements. And when women are involved in peace processes, they seek to address the underlying roots of the conflict, what gave rise to war in the first place. And so we find that the peace agreements are then more sustainable when women have a seat at the table. These are just a few of the trends that we're seeing.
Fascinating. And who keeps track of these things? You're talking about the trends happening worldwide since World War II. Who's tracking, you know, violence, homicide, and war globally? Is it an organization that does it or the UN?
There are over 700 peace research institutes around the world employing some 12,000 researchers. The best is considered the Peace Research Institute of Oslo in Norway, founded by Johan Galtung. Then we also have the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute in Sweden, which is the gold standard. They're very, very well funded by the Swedish government. We have the Correlates of War Project at the University of Michigan, which was one of the first. And I really give a lot of credit to the University of Colorado as well. They started a huge conflict consortium where they tracked many trends. Heidi and Guy Burgess and Paul Weir were some of the early peace researchers in this area. We have Meta Spencer up in Canada at the Toronto Peace Research Institute, and many, many faculty. When I first started out in this field of peace studies in 1981, there were only 29 undergraduate programs in the study of peace and human rights, and now we have over 500 in the United States alone and Canada. So all of the faculty and students are also doing research in this with our counterparts, our sisters and brothers at the Australian University Peace Research Institute in Canberra, Christchurch in New Zealand, all of the Japanese universities. We have many, many networks. There is an international peace research association of academics and scholars, and there are over 32 journals in the field now. So many, many different hubs of inquiry, and of course we also use CIA data, State Department data, and the United Nations is a huge player in all of this. They have defense and disarmament research institutes, and we draw from their work all the time, the Office of Peace Education. The global campaign for peace education coming out of the Hague Appeal for Peace has also networked kindergarten through 12th grade teachers and university academics to try and document the rise of peace education around the world. All of these efforts combined give us some of the critical data points.
It's really encouraging to hear this, you know, and it's something we see often on this radio show. We talk about breakthrough solutions with different people in different fields, and we had a gentleman on recently who talked about the decline in worldwide hunger that's not getting the attention that deserves. But it's, I think, a real disservice of the media that so much attention is put on the violence that does happen and the whole guiding principle of media. If it bleeds, it leads. So we hear all about any bombs that go off or anyone who's involved in a gunfight somewhere, but we almost never hear about what you're talking about, which is this incredible, as you say, like a worldwide architecture of peace, the peace researchers, the peace trainers, the peace activists, who are out there around the United States and around the world trying to prevent conflict and trying to restore order after conflict has happened. So I appreciate
right.
you opening the window into that whole world for us.
And the soldiers. We can't forget the soldiers, and they know that war is not healthy. And we see that 20 veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan every day are taking their own lives. If war was working and if war was a natural phenomenon and actually inevitable, then why does war make so many people mentally unstable and hurt them so much emotionally? Why do 20 of our brave servicemen and women take their lives every day? And that's really, you know, that's really, really disturbing. So I know a lot of soldiers that have stepped up and, you know, graduates of West Point and soldiers in my classes where I teach. I have many Iraq and Afghan war veterans in my courses, and they enrich the discussion so much, and they seek to provide solutions as well. So we can't forget that they are helping to lead and inspire others to stand up against war. And I do think that the media misframes violence. They don't understand violence in a way that provides solutions. They leave people without agency, so that when you read the media, you become depressed. And we wonder why more and more young people have stopped reading the newspaper. They don't feel like they have any power to change things. So we really need to offer solution-based journalism, peace journalism, yes journalism.
Right, exactly. Well, I totally agree with you about the media being disempowering. I even this week with the terrorist attack in Belgium, I talked to my sister about it, and she was really upset about it. Of course, we all were, and our hearts went out to the people in Brussels. But I think it's a real problem, somewhat in the newspaper, but even worse on television, that our nervous systems are not made to withstand seeing that kind of dramatic, you know, attacks on people and blood and just horrendous situation. If you were, you know, God forbid, one of the people in that situation, you would see it once because you live through it. But with the media, they keep replaying it and re-traumatizing. And right. As you say, you know, they don't give you any agency, is your phrase, or they don't say, well, what can you do to deal with this or to stop this? So it's extremely disempowering in the media. And I'm so grateful that PRN here allows the space for us to talk about solutions and what's working and what we can do.
Right. And when you see the scenes of carnage on television, they never explain what has given rise to extremist violence. What is at the roots of this? And it reminds me of the ancient Chinese proverb and story about all the babies being put in the river. And villagers find the babies floating down the river, and they're drowning. And all the villagers create a brigade to try and get those babies out of the river and try and save the drowning babies. But nobody ever asks who's putting the babies in the river upstream. So we need to get at the roots of the extremist violence. What's giving rise to extremist violence? What is there? Why is there so much rage? Why is there so much disenfranchisement? How can we counter that through peace education, through being inclusive, through helping people, through social inclusion and jobs and income generation and faith-based groups and so many positive aspects that are out there? What are these young people hungry for? Why have they felt so humiliated? Why do they feel the necessity to join an extremist group? And now we're starting to get defectors from these extremist groups, and we're actually able to interview them and find out what drove them to join, why did they defect. And they were ignorant of a lot of the practices when they got over there to places like Syria and Iraq and Yemen. They learned that ISIS and these other groups were not what they touted, were not what they promised to be. They were also recoiling and repugnant by the extreme violence and the beheadings. Some of them were interviewed by institutes in the Middle East, and the beheadings really completely repugnated them. And They also thought they were going to have a better life. They also saw infighting among the leadership of ISIS. So all of these things combined caused some of them to defect. I only read interviews with 47 who have defected so far.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating. I'm curious, given your expertise in preventing peace and dealing with violent situations, you know, let's take this Brussels explosion this week as a prime case of kind of some of what Europe is now under siege with. The United States has been hit with it in San Bernardino and other places. And yes, not that many people are directly affected, but actually, in a sense, we're all affected because it leaves us feeling insecure and not knowing if I get on a train or head to the capital of the city, is there going to be an explosion today on that? So what do you think, if you were advising the president right now, what would you advise the president to do and to try and prevent these kinds of terrorist attacks from happening?
Well, I think that there are those with moral authority in these communities that could reach out to the young people to encourage them not to join. And we've seen this work in many other places. We can't get to the extremists themselves, some of the leaders and some of the ringleaders, but we can use a spectrum of allies. We can try to use leverage over those who may in fact know them. And through various networks and relationships, we can try to influence the young people in these communities not to join. So there are moral figures. There are those with moral authority who could speak out, and we could seek to activate. And many of the imams worldwide and the moderate Islamic scholars and others have spoken out and issued proclamations that extremist violence is not in keeping with Islam, that Islam is a religion based in peace. And the word Islam means peace. But I also take very seriously state terrorism from above, that one of the things I would recommend very strongly to world leaders is to stop using drones and bombs and raining terror on innocent civilian populations and stop, kicking in doors and dragging people from their beds in various areas of the world, which only breeds more extremism. So there's state terrorism from above, and there's terrorism from below, and these things feed off of against each other. So the militarists are actually reinforcing each other in both of these communities. I listened to all the pundits and all the policymakers after the attacks in Brussels, and they only had one tool in their toolkit, which was more bombings. These were the extremists on what I consider some of the former foreign policy advisors to George W. Bush were calling for more bombings of ISIS. I think the Europeans and many other countries are trying to use careful police work. And we know through research studies, even by conservative sources like the RAND Corporation, that only 7% of extremist groups have ever been brought down through military action. 47% of them have been brought down through careful police work, Interpol and investigations and international cooperations transnationally with police forces all over the country, all over the world. And the rest of the extremist groups or terrorist groups joined political parties like the Irish Republican Army or Sinn Féin, the Shining Path, and some of these others in various places like the Basque region of Spain. So Eitan and others joined political parties, and we have seen where that has worked as well. But you think of the sarin gas attacks on the Tokyo subways in Japan. They didn't go in and start bombing. They used careful police work, and they caught all of the perpetrators of that, or the Barcelona attacks on the trains. So that's what we need more of. We need more resources put into careful police work. We know that that is what is more effective ultimately in bringing them down. Now, very religious fundamentalist groups are difficult to end. They are the most difficult to end. And that's why I think we really need to offer solutions. I feel that young people all over the world are yearning to be part of something greater than themselves. And they are morally adrift in many instances. They're rudderless. And they want a heart in a heartless world. And some of these young people are glomming on to neo-Nazi groups in the United States, white supremacist groups, really radical, organizations. And the same is true throughout the Middle East. You see that people feel disenfranchised. They've been under the boot of authoritarian regimes for a long time. And unfortunately, the United States has been supporting many of those regimes in places like Saudi Arabia, Bahrain. You know the history. I don't need to recite it all. And so they feel like they've not been on the side of democracy. They've had to live under very extreme repression, and then they don't have any jobs as well, or little economic prospects, few social services, poor educational systems. And I'm thinking of places like Egypt. Obviously, the very oil-rich countries are not in the same boat in terms of their educational systems. They've been invaded and attacked so many times in the Middle East over the centuries by so many different powers, and they have a deep sense of humiliation. And if you know anything about Arab cultures, it's that their dignity is really important to them, and their sense of pride, especially Arab men. The sense of humiliation is very, very deep. So if I was advising presidents and foreign ministers, I would say, unleash Fulbright programs and Peace Corps programs and citizen exchange programs and young people studying abroad in each other's countries. Globalization from below. We have all this globalization from above. But if we could have worldwide movements of citizens reaching out and getting to know each other, this is called contact hypothesis. The more we get to know each other, the less likely we are to be enemies. Those are just a few of my ideas, but I think I would unleash peace education and things like the Peace Corps instead of bombings and drones, and I would reach out to all of the spiritual leaders around the world, from Bishop Tutu in South Africa to the Pope to all the imams in the world, and ask if they could influence those not to take up arms. And I think the arms dealers have a great deal to be accountable for. Human Rights Watch and some of the big human rights groups have a wonderful website you can go to called StopTheAtrocitiesSupplyChain.org. And it lists all of the major weapons dealers that are making so much money off these wars. 78% of all arms sales go to the Middle East. And we wonder why the place is a tinderbox. Lots of scholars that have written on this beautifully, like William Hartung and Steve Zunis, Laura Lumpy. We will get what we prepare for. If we flood the Middle East with weapons, then there's going to be militarism, violence, and terrorism.
Yeah, well, there's a lot in what you're saying, and that's quite a program. I'd love to see you write that up and maybe publish that and make that available to the president and to the Congress and to the Pentagon. But, I was interested in one of the things you mentioned, that so often when there's a response, say this week around Brussels, that the one tool that they pull out of the toolkit is to focus on more bombings. And, just as one example of that, Senator Ted Cruz, running for the Republican nomination for president, said that what he wanted to do was to have more of these police in security parading around and knocking on doors and pulling out anyone who would be a potential insurgent or terrorist. And while I think the emphasis on police work is correct, as you say, the way he was talking about it reminded me very much of what the British tried to do with the Irish Republican Army in Northern Ireland, which you referred to that as you were speaking, the IRA. And it just so completely backfired, because if you're taking that kind of a strong militaristic attack approach, it only served to strengthen the IRA and to increase community support for them. So we need to be careful about, in the various efforts that we do initiate, we don't want a blowback that actually strengthens the hands of the troublemakers. But I like
yeah,
your
well,
focus.
So, yeah. So many young men in Iraq and Afghanistan said that that's why they took up arms against the occupying force, because they were humiliated in front of their families, their friends, and their neighborhoods when U.S. forces kicked down doors and dragged them from their beds. It created 10 more terrorists. And soldiers in my classes have told me the same thing. And I did have senior officers in my classes who said to me, you want to know the origins of ISIS? Well, I'll tell you the origins of ISIS. We rounded up 15,000 Sunni men in the Iraqi desert during the U.S. invasion, and we put them behind barbed wires, even in front of their children, and they threw themselves against the barbed wire and threw themselves against the barbed wire, bloodying themselves in the prison camps, open-air prison camps, and then we hauled them off to Abu Ghraib and tortured them. And even documented it through pictures, which of course went viral, and all kinds of young Arab men around the world saw how we humiliated Muslims and Iraqis naked in chains or with the dogs and photographing them and brutalizing them and all kinds of torture I don't even want to get into, and waterboarding. And, you know, these kinds of policies give rise to extremist violence. And so we really need to get at the roots of that. There needs to be atonement on all sides. But right now, the militarists on both sides are reinforcing each other and creating a spiral of violence, that we have to be violence interrupters in this regard. Everybody wants dignity. They want dignity where they live, in their homes. And I think fundamentally we all want peace. I think people of goodwill can disagree about how to achieve peace, but clearly war is not working. We've been stuck in this cycle of violence since the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, and it's only getting worse. Unfortunately, militaries only have one tool in their toolbox. If they have, you know, a hammer, then everything in the world looks like a nail. In the field of peace research and peace education, we're trying to widen the toolkit. We're trying to broaden the repertoire of all that could be tried, whether it's legal strategies to bring people to the bar of justice at the International Criminal Court, whether it's through the schools, through the mosques, through civic organizations, through citizen exchange programs.
Yeah, I think that's a great approach about broadening the strategies, increasing the number of tools in your toolbox. Yeah. Obviously, military is one, and there are some times when you need that. But there's so much more that could be done. And when you're talking to some of the people who live in the Mideast, and they say for a lot of the young people, there really isn't much of a hope of a good future. And it's hard to get a good school, you know, good education, get a good job. There's just millions of youth kind of wandering around without any purpose in life, and they become susceptible to being sucked into some of these radical religious fundamentalist extremists. And
we're seeing that in the United States as well. I think that's
right.
Why a lot of people are starting to follow Trump. So we can't just judge other cultures in this regard. And so civic life is so important, and, you know, joining, civilizing movements, the labor movement, the peace movement, the environmental movement, social justice movements, helping the poor with their housing, joining things like scouting, conservation corps, whatever it would take, then you could feel something greater than yourself. You could be a part of something greater than yourself instead of just playing video games or, you know, the average U.S. kid spends 7 hours in front of a screen and 7 minutes outside every day. Yeah, I mean, it's just, they're becoming so disconnected, and we're becoming disconnected from the earth. And if we could be outdoors and restoring our parks and our waterways and our streams, and people could feel connected to the planet, I think it would have a great healing effect.
Yeah, war also
I think,
pollutes.
And that's a great idea. And also, you know, have some of those be jobs for youth like we did during the Depression. There's so many of the millennials, the young people coming up, they don't have anything, you know, they've had trouble getting a start in their life, had trouble getting jobs. So let's put them to work, like you said, helping to improve our nature areas. And I wanted to also connect back in with one of the points you made in terms of the importance of citizen exchanges, and that if we can have some people, particularly when they're young, to come from the Mideast, come to the U.S., because so much of what they hear, and in fact, sometimes all of what they hear about the U.S. is about the U.S.'s devil and, you know, big problems, and they're taught to hate us and want to destroy us and all that. Just if they would come and kind of meet the people, you know, a lot of those false images fall apart pretty quickly. There was one of the most fascinating instances of that I know is in my alma mater there at Yale. They accepted into the Yale College the young man who was the communications director for the Taliban in Afghanistan. And they brought him in. He went through the four-year program, and it was just fascinating to read the interviews with him and what he was saying based on what he thought when he came, and then how his experience of seeing, meeting Americans, having college life, and being taught in kind of a liberal, open education just completely opened his mind. He said, you know, everything that I thought I knew was wrong, and nothing like direct experience. So I love to see those kinds of exchanges. So when you do have some of the ones that are incorrigible, I think the ones that are really core on ISIS, they don't want jobs, they don't want freedom, they want Armageddon, and they want to destroy anyone who's not their version of Muslim. So, you know, some of those guys, if that's how they're thinking, you know, you're not going to change them. It's, in a sense, it may be too late with them, but what if we could isolate them and then make sure that other people had a quality education and a chance at a good job, I think you just then drain the swamp and make it less likely that the young men are going to be drawn into these extremist violent activities.
Yes, well, I had a very interesting experience going to Europe to be part of a dialogue group with young neo-Nazis. This was a man who had been in the SS when he was a youth, and Friedrich Heinrich, and he was an industrialist when he grew up. And he admitted that at 14 years old he had been recruited into the Nazi youth program. It was after the war that he learned the horrors of the extent of what the Third Reich had done, and he devoted his whole life to peace as atonement, and he set up a foundation for violence-free living, and he sought to stop the recruitment of young people in Germany into neo-Nazi groups. And so he gathered us all at his foundation, and for 5 days, peace educators from around the world sought to talk with these youth, have dialogue with them. It was only at the end of the 5 days that these neo-Nazi youth learned I was Jewish. And you could see the cognitive dissonance in their eyes. They were deeply unsettled by this, and they began to draw away from the leader in the group, the ringleader, and they were practicing critical thinking on their own after this intensive period together with peace educators. We could never reach the ringleader. I could see in his eyes that we were dealing with a closed system. And I would say that there was something clinical about him. He was so fanatical in his views. But the followers, we were able to inoculate them, and they left the Nazi group. And that's what we have to do. As you say, you can't often reach the most hard-bitten, the most fanatical, or those that might even have sociopathic, you know, tendencies. But I think that we can ameliorate the conditions that give rise to extremist violence, and we can seek to inoculate youth. And I saw it firsthand, you know, where they did break with their leader, And I've done that with gangs in U.S. inner cities, when we offered them alternative livelihoods, when we offered them a better way of supporting their families and their lives than drugs, when we tried to offer skills as a response to violence instead of weapons. It shifted something in their culture, in their neighborhood. I lived in Harlem for 12 years and also inner city Washington, D.C., and done a lot of work with violent gangs. And we were able to shift the subcultures in a lot of these neighborhoods when we offered them hope and when we got them involved in other activities, and they felt greater than the, you know, the sum of their parts, and they were able to get involved in networks that gave them pride and dignity and a sense of belonging and a sense of community, but didn't require them to hurt others or cause bloodshed.
Yeah, great. Well, you know, you mentioned about what's happening here in the United States, so let's talk about this right now and the rise of Donald Trump and what we can do about that. It seems to me that we've got a combination where Americans are, afraid about these terrorist attacks, about a changing world with what they see as increased violence, increased vulnerability, the tremendous sense of insecurity. And I think that does get exaggerated by the media and how they treat things like the Brussels explosion. But nevertheless, I mean, that is a threat that had not been there, say, 30 years ago. So there is kind of this fear of being under siege, the fear, you know, that we're, the sense that we're losing, that some Americans are feeling humiliated about or are feeling less powerful. As, you know, they seem powerless, they're seeing the whole war in Syria and what's the U.S. role and, you know, how come we can't stop the source of the problem there in Syria leading to millions of these refugees pouring across Europe now. And that combined with the economic inequality that's been building really since 1980 with President Reagan and on to now, that so much of the wealth is going to the top 10% or even the top 1%, and feeling economically that they're losing and they can't get ahead, maybe losing homes, losing jobs, and that the next generation is going to be in a less good situation than this generation, which is so against the sense of the American dream and the sense of hope and possibility for the future. So all of that kind of creates an environment in which a strong man and someone, you know, to me, he's like a big, slick snake oil salesman, Donald Trump. He just says, America will be great again. I'll solve all your problems. This is going to be wonderful. He never says how he's going to do it. There's no explanation of what the plan or program is. He just likes is selling the snake oil, but we've got him here, 35-40% of the people voting in the Republican primaries are voting for him. So what do you see is the cause of the rise of Donald Trump, and what do you think we can do to deal with this kind of strongman, bigoted, narrow-minded, almost misogynist leader that's emerging in the United States?
Yes. Well, there are a lot of factors and forces and variables that come together in this discussion. I do think we're at a different stage of capitalism. I think we're witnessing tectonic shifts in capitalism with the rise of global capitalism. And we are in a different stage of capitalism where major corporations are seeking cheap labor, going abroad, refusing to pay taxes, they are undermining the very nations where they perhaps made their fortunes. So we were just seeing in the business sections of the papers in recent months, some of the top U.S. corporations have moved offshore to avoid taxes. They're going where labor is cheapest. Some of them are going to Ireland, which has a highly educated and highly skilled workforce, but has very low tax rates. So corporations are accelerating a race to the bottom, and people are upset about that. But I think some of the American public, a large swath of the American public, might be vulnerable, might be easily seduced by very simple answers, black and white answers, a big strong man, because they lack political literacy. They're not reading widely. They are not traveling widely. I imagine a lot of them have never been abroad, don't own a passport. So you've got a lot of ignorance. And this relates back to the Reagan Revolution, where they systematically undermined public education across the country. We have seen a defunding of the social safety net. We've seen defunding of public schools. We've seen the privatization of schools. So people are not getting the kind of broad-based education we once had. We also lack a sense of unity. I mean, we all used to perhaps, you know, watch one national television show, if you will, like a Walter Cronkite or something like that. Now everybody's carved up into their own echo chambers with Fox News or liberal media or other forms of news outlets. So people don't have a common purpose anymore. There's been a dumbing down of the American public, and people are easily seduced by answers because they lack political literacy. At the same time, their wages have declined. We've seen a steady decline in real earnings since the 1970s. So there are real structural changes that are going on in capitalism. And this also relates to war, because the exact amount of money that we have spent on wars over the years could help rebuild the infrastructure in the United States. So right now they're estimating that it would cost about $6 trillion to rebuild all the highways, bridges, light rail transport, railroads in the United States, restore our forests, but particularly the bridges and the roads. That's how much we've spent on Iraq and Afghanistan in the last 14 years. So isn't it interesting that exactly what we need to restore our nation and create greater numbers of jobs is exactly what we've spent on war? And we know that money spent in the civilian sector creates 10 times the amount of jobs than in the military sector. Military spending is very capital intensive, and it only benefits a small sector of scientists, engineers, highly trained machinists making warheads, this kind of thing. They have embedded military spending into all 50 states if you look at the way in which military spending is spread out. So some sectors would make a bolt for a wing on a plane, or, you know, you have decentralized some of the military jobs into congressional districts across the country, so everybody has a piece of the pie. But flip the script on that and turn it into green energy jobs, shift us away from fossil fuels, building solar, geothermal, and wind, and you could bring full employment back to the United States and create much greater numbers of jobs. So these, we have to connect the dots for people, and this requires nuanced, subtle, sophisticated analysis, which somebody like Donald Trump lacks. We have to have an integrated, holistic analysis. What is real security? What constitutes human security? Is it solely through military strength, or is there something deeper? There's many forms of power in societies, and I think it's very interesting that when we had a despotic government in Belgrade under Slobodan Milosevic, and he was causing massive numbers of refugees across Kosovo, Bosnia, Croatia and elsewhere, and he was repressing his own people. What did the United States do ultimately after we realized that bombing of Belgrade wasn't working and people were rallying around the flag and actually galvanized Milosevic's support? We then turned around and funded a nonviolent struggle there. People in the State Department, those that were in charge during the Clinton years, actually decided to fund civil society when they realized the bombings weren't working. And they began capacity building with young democracy activists, with OTPOR. and so did the European Union. And they put, I believe, $23 million into nonviolence trainings, computers, electoral organizing, grassroots organizing, getting out the vote, helping young people in Otpor to forge a coalition of all of the opposition figures so that they could gain strength against Milosevic. What if we had done that against Assad in Syria instead of sending weapons, instead of putting fuel on the fire in the Middle East, if we had sought to strengthen the democratic forces, the nonviolent forces inside Syria? The activists came to us very, very early on in Washington, and they said, we have a nonviolent movement in Syria, and we're opposing Assad because we don't have jobs. There's a water shortage going on thanks to global warming. There's going to be projected hunger in certain areas of Syria. So we've begun to march against him and protest his repressive reign and that of his father all these years. And we have a nonviolent movement, but every time we go out on the streets, Assad picks us off with snipers on the roof, 3 at a time, 10 at a time. It's a low-intensity conflict strategy against the nonviolent movement. And they tried to appeal to people in Washington to strengthen that peace movement. And the women of Syria were calling for peace and democracy strengthening, such as we had done in Yugoslavia or Serbia. But we abandoned them, and they were crushed. There are still people inside Syria and many, many women still organizing for peace. But imagine if we had put the amount of money into building the capacity of the peace movement in Syria compared to the armed insurrection, what could the outcome look like differently today?
That's an excellent question, and I, you know, there's just such tremendous work done by Gene Sharp and by others who just talk about the use of nonviolence as a very effective strategy for undermining these despotic regimes. And I was not aware that the people in Syria had requested that support from the United States. That makes me very sad to know that that opportunity was there and we kind of missed that. But and we do have so many people now who are skilled because of your work and other people who have helped to build up this whole field of peace studies. And I love your phrase called the violence interrupters, people who are trained and can help encourage nonviolent civil disobedience or resistance to despotic regimes. Who are some of the violence interrupters today? Who's doing that kind of training that we might want to support and encourage?
Oh, my gosh, there's so many. Well, the most famous probably that was documented in a film were the Operation Ceasefire in Chicago. Unfortunately, they lost some of their funding. But we have people in the schools, people like MJ Park and Little Friends of Peace in some of the poorest schools in the Washington, D.C. area, Maryland and Virginia. She also does work in El Salvador. There are many, many women's movements around the world that are trying to persuade their sons and children not to join extremist groups and to stay out of the gangs. You know, those mothers who had lost their sons and daughters to police gun violence came to Washington last year for Mother's Day and testified before Congress, please get the guns off the streets, please stop allowing police brutality. They're coming back to Washington again to testify again in Mother's Day this spring, 2016. We have peace radio programs around the world that are trying to broadcast peace radio, and we even have those inside Syria. Raqqa is Suffering Silently is a radio program run by young people. They also do all kinds of development work in the community, trying to get clean water to people. And when ISIS tried to shut them down, 10,000 people showed up to protect them in the neighborhood. Four of their people, as you know, were assassinated in Istanbul when they went to Turkey for training. But that radio program continues and is continuing to broadcast. It's very important to have shows like yours and other peace journalism and peace radio stations that are trying to interrupt hate rhetoric and hate talk, vehement, poisonous kinds of radio, which we know helped give rise to the genocide in Rwanda. It was hate radio shows in Rwanda that began to escalate the rhetoric against the Tutsis. And on all sides, we've seen it in other areas. Well, of course, the Nazis were the best at this, at propaganda radio. And we have peace radio programs now, the Women's Peace News Network, and other forms like Transcend puts out a peace radio program every week, peace television. Actually, there was a orbiting satellite that was deteriorating that the NASA gave to the University of Hawaii so they could broadcast peace radio programs around the Pacific. And this is very important for inoculating and vaccinating people against hate. Now, Donald Trump, unfortunately, has a larger megaphone and is spewing his poisonous rhetoric across the country. How can we reach people to realize that that is not how we're going to exist and coexist into the future? We have to really heal relationships and forge civil, cordial mutual respect and dignity for all. Our liberation and our freedoms are all tied to each other. I mean, Martin Luther King said it better than anything I could say, that we're all tied in a beautiful tapestry, a beautiful fabric. Our destinies are forever linked, and we need to really work to repair the threads of our society that have been torn asunder by some of these hate mongers, these war peddlers. They're going to lead us to disaster.
Yes, and it's so hopeful that there is such a large and growing body of the violence interrupters and the peace educators. And one of the things I respect about you, Barbara, is that you do reach out. You don't just speak to the converted. I know you've taught in the U.S. war colleges. So what was that like when you're in there with the military and you're presenting your point of view in a setting that is used to having that one tool in the toolbox, which is war? What were you saying to them, and how did they respond?
Well, I was invited into the National Defense University at Fort McNair and West Point and other places over the years since 81, and also at Annapolis. And they were hungry for alternatives. I will tell you that soldiers and the military are the last people who want to go to war.
Right.
And as you know, the Joint Chiefs of Staff testified against the invasion of Iraq. And also the Joint Chiefs of Staff have said that we don't need all these Cold War weapon systems. But the Pentagon succumbs to Congress, and the big arms dealers also put pressure on Congress, and that whole iron triangle between the Pentagon, Congress, and the weapons manufacturers are often what drives military spending. And I've heard time and again former soldiers or current chiefs of staff speak out. We don't need all this military spending, those old tanks or those old troop carriers, and yet the military spending goes forward. So very often when I was in those settings, they were hungry for alternatives. They were sitting forward in their seats, intellectually thirsty for ideas of what else could be tried. And I will say that some militaries are bridging over to do more humanitarian kind of missions. And we do see armies around the world going in for large-scale reconstruction after a tsunami or after an earthquake. They're the only ones that can mobilize the equipment and the staff, medical personnel and others, to get to the victims of natural disasters. So there are militaries around the world that are trying to move in this direction, away from war fighting and more to large-scale humanitarian reconstruction. We do have 23 nations in the world that have now abolished their standing armies and are trying to transition to peaceful, green economies for the future and get away from fossil fuel so we don't have to fight wars over oil in the Middle East. And that's very promising. of course, the Canadians and others have always been major peacekeepers and not war fighters. They put far more money into international peacekeeping and human rights monitoring. That's the kind of thing I would like to see militaries used for careful police work and the protection of civilians instead of foreign invasions and occupations. But I do think that soldiers are often at the mercy of policymakers. I'm struck by that scene in Michael Moore's movie where he went up to Capitol Hill and every elected official that was leaving their office, he asked them, "Do you have a son or daughter in Iraq?" Not a single one did, except for Biden and McCain. And yet they were authorizing war. And what if it was their kids over there? So I think that sometimes we misunderstand militaries. They're very practical. They're very down-to-earth, very forthright men and women. I enjoy working with soldiers. I enjoy working with militaries because I think that they have a very realistic view of what war is like.
Right. That's fascinating. And we're just about out of time here. Just very briefly, if our listeners want to learn more about your work, do you have a website or how can they be connected with what you're doing?
Well, they can enroll at American University. We have a very large peace studies program there. We're with 180 master's students and PhD students on the alternatives to war and violence. And then we have undergraduate track on peace, global security, and conflict resolution. They can come to programs. They can join, you know, peace centers in their communities. They can join Women's Action for New Directions, National Peace Action, the War Resisters League, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the Rotary Club International and Lions Club sponsor peace essay contests and fund scholarships to study peace. They offer art contests with children on peace. So many, many civic groups have gotten involved. Congregations are sponsoring peace essay contests and awards for kids. So there's many ways to get involved.
That's wonderful, and that's all the time we have. Farmer Ween, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your work for peace.
Thank you, Eleanor LeCain. Thank you for your good voice in this world.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.